Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways. Let James Holland take you to places in history you've never been before. The Savage Storm is the fascinating new book which brings to life the story of our Allied forces as they crossed into southern Italy in 1943. With unflinching and insightful detail, Holland places you in the heart of the action of this pivotal and brutal World War II battle. The Savage Storm is out now and available from all good bookshops. Achtung, Achtung. Welcome to We Have Ways of Making You Talk with me, Al Murray, and James Holland. This is a special live edition of the pod from Chalk Valley History Festival, where we discussed the top five British blunders and successes of the war. And we got heckled by a man with a bugle.
Hello, everyone. I see lots of our merchandise, but not enough. That's my first initial thought, viewing this crowd.
That's pretty strong, though, isn't it?
That's very strong.
That's a doubleheader on that table.
On that table, the Firefly shirt, which is in the olive drab, which is very strong.
Yeah, it's very good.
And then the one with our faces on, which I keep seeing around the place.
Yeah, I'm less keen on that one. When's the new image coming
it's
in?
It's a much better photograph. I look so much like a baked potato on the original artwork.
I just look quiff-tastic. I just feel a bit weird about it.
Right, so what were we gonna talk about? I've just been over with the garrison, though. So up the other end of this field is the garrison, who are an artillery project, they're keeping Second World War British Second World War artillery alive. And I've just had the chat about the anti-tank weapons.
You met Keith?
Yeah, it's just brilliant. Yeah. And he was saying, well, what you've got to remember is it's not the gun that's the weapon. In anti-tank munitions, it's the round, and you've got to just forget about the gun. It's the round, and when you look at the six-pounder, the discarding sabot round is going 1,000 feet per second faster than the standard armored piercing shot. And then even the two-pounder, they put that thing on that squeezes the round on its way out, and that is going as quick as a six-pounder's round by the end of the war. So he's saying, it's not the gun, it's not how long the gun is, and all the sort of basically the phallic stuff. It's what's flying out of the enormous metal penis that's important.
What a horrible image.
Yeah, but, you know, it wasn't wrong though, was it?
No.
But what were we going to talk about, Jim?
Well, first of all, we haven't done Achtung, Achtung, but since we're focusing on Britain today, we're going to go tally-ho, tally-ho.
Tally-ho, tally-ho.
So we're going to do... here we are on our lovely little corner of England.
Yep.
And I think we should sort of focus on Britain, because that's where we are today.
Yep.
You know, not
yep.
that we ever do. And I thought we could do Britain's five greatest moments in the war and Britain's probably... less
it's
good
not,
moments
it's not
in
the
war.
Bugling.
It's the Boy Scouts.
Yeah, so it's top five sort of achievement-y, moment-y things, and then probably five biggest blunders.
Yeah,
we might go for.
Which way around are we going to do it then?
What do you want first, the blunders or the
blunders?
Start
first.
With the blunders. Okay.
Let's get the bad stuff out of the way, and then we can end on a crescendo of glory.
High. Yeah. Okay. Right. So,
are we going to order them as well? Probably. Be quite fun.
Well, I think we talk about the five and then we pick an order. That's what we do. So we talk around the five and then we go, this was the worst. So.
It's time to start.
There's some sort of last stand occurring over there that we don't know about. if you're listening to this in podcast form, there's a bugle the other side of the... He's finished now, isn't he? Someone shot the bugler. Excellent. Right. So, should we do the five big blunders first?
Yeah.
Okay. What do you want to go with?
Well, should we do it chronologically?
Yeah.
They're all basically at the beginning.
Yeah. 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 Well, it's basically phase one of the Second World War is Allies caught with trousers round ankles, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's basically it. And also, the Germans have been really getting ready, not just in terms of kit and stuff, but they're getting their heads around the idea of doing it.
Yep.
And training enthusiastically for it. And there's nothing like to get people up for a fight than telling them they're not allowed an army. If you really want to get the Prussian military class thinking of... He's getting closer. If you want to... it's Spike Milligan. Yeah. So basically, you ban the Germans from having an army. The one thing they're going to Germany at that time is going to really think about doing is fighting and having one. So that's really what happens at the start of the war. Is the Germans have their trousers firmly up and done up, and the British have them around their ankles.
Yeah, but okay. So not an awful lot happens in 1939 that you can really sort of go, that was grotesquely bad. I mean. Well, dropping leaflets on Wilhelmshaven is probably not brilliant.
Worrying about property damage.
Yeah, okay, so that's quite bad. That's
I've never been heckled by a bugle before. I've been heckled by children. I've been heckled by farm machinery. But never a bugle. So it's the first time for everything.
He's a lot better than most, though. I'll give him that.
Yeah, yeah.
So 1940, I don't think you can really... Oh, Jesus. Should we just get him over here? Just get it over and done with.
Feel like doing the end of it, Ain't Half Hot Mum.
Shut up! Soldiers back, lovely boy.
Soldiers back, lovely boy. Oh dear, what a pity, never mind. Anyway.
We're not allowed to talk about that anymore.
No, not that programme is verboten now.
It's cancelled.
Yeah. Anyway, go on.
So 1940, I don't think Dunkirk, you can really... You know, that was all the French fault, wasn't it?
Well, yes, but it's not like really the BF covers itself in particular glory, does
it? Well, I don't know.
The deal line plan is really stupid.
Yeah, I know, but that's French decision.
Yeah, but why are we going along with French decisions? Why?
Because they're in charge.
That sounds to me like a top five blunder right there. Putting the French in charge. I think we've picked our absolute number one blunder.
But how many how many divisions have they got and how many have we got? They've got 105, we've got 10.
Yeah.
Belgium's got 15, Holland's got 20.
Yeah.
You know.
Anyway, all right, okay. So you're saying the Battle of France...
It doesn't go 100% to plan, obviously.
Doesn't count as a... British blunder.
Well, it does count as a British blunder, but I wouldn't say that's in the top five blunders.
All right, okay.
You know, and they get all the men off.
All right, okay.
338,000, you know.
All right, okay.
You know, wars aren't won by retreats, but...
No, I mean, you know, the Germans can't defeat you if you're not there. It's as simple as that.
I think you could argue a blunder is putting all the Royal Navy down in the southeast of England in the summer of 1940.
Yeah.
You know, that's not that smart. And, you know, Admiral Charles Forbes, CNC of the Home Fleet, he's suggesting that actually we don't need to do that, and he's overruled, isn't he?
Yeah. That's him being overruled right now. So, oh God, just
squeeze one last one out.
We're 9 months into the war now, and we haven't made an error.
Well, no, I'm saying we made errors. We just...
He's not coming next year, is he?
Well, he might do, but only if he comes to our stage.
So we're just... You know what we're going to have to do, James?
We're just going to have to
endure it like in 1940.
Yeah. Lots and lots of errors, but I wouldn't say that they're in the top five of wartime errors.
Right, so...
But you know, I think the kind of keeping the home fleet in the southeast of England is potentially one. Because as a result of that, the U-boats had their first happy time.
Yep.
Unescorted convoys, all the rest of it. You know, it didn't need to be that way. And
okay, so let's make our way into the autumn.
Okay, so then autumn... Well, Battle of Britain was pretty successful, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, you say that, right?
Well, I do say that, yeah.
Yeah, but here's a thought... Sea Lion can never work.
So what's the point?
So is the Battle of Britain a critical victory if Sea Lion can never work?
Ooh.
No, it isn't, right? Because if they try Sea Lion, it won't work. So it doesn't matter that the outcome of the Battle of Britain is essentially irrelevant because Sea Lion can never work.
No.
I've got him here. He hasn't heard this one before.
No. Okay.
Come straight out of left. This is... Do you see what I mean, though?
Yeah, I do. But... It still absolutely hammers the Luftwaffe. The Luftwaffe have less planes in June 1941 on the eve of Barbarossa than they do on the 10th of May, your birthday, Yeah, well, 40, that, obviously not that, much. 40
yeah,
though.
Yeah, the, yeah, yeah, absolutely. So the kicking the Luftwaffe takes,
but also the attrition it totally disrupts Hitler's war plans.
Yeah,
because the whole point is the whole way the German war machine is set up is to have quick victories in a fortnight or a couple of weeks or 6 weeks or you know, a couple of months or something like that, and then you win. And then eventually you can turn to the Soviet Union, have your Lebensraum and take over the world. Mwahaha.
Yeah.
But you can't, you're being hustled into that because Britain's still there. So it's like, damn, that doesn't work because hovering in the background is the United States of America with all their industrial potential, et cetera, manpower, blah, blah, blah. And we need to turn back and hit them. And we can't because we haven't got... you're going to have to kind of, you know, you're going to have to... So from Hitler's point of view, he's having to turn to... Oh, he wobbled then. You're going to have to turn into the Soviet Union far earlier than you were ever going to because you've still got Britain in the war and the United States hovering in the background.
And your economy's running hot.
All that.
Their empire's costing them more to run than it was. I mean, the interesting thing is the German European empire, Western European empire, the economy collapses completely. So before the war starts, the whole of Europe is much more productive economically. And the moment Germany disrupts everyone's economies by invading them, the economy basically completely falls in on itself. And France goes from being pretty buoyant to just falling on its arse. And the Germans aren't able to get the French to build things for them. And
well, that's because they nick all their cars, nickel their fuel, nickel their money, nickel their coal, and everything.
So
the Germans are like kids in sweet shops. And, you know, the larder is bare by Christmas 1940.
Yeah.
So what do? So you've got to go into the Soviet Union earlier So I think the Battle of Britain is really important for that. But I'm kind of potentially eating my own sandwiches for later on.
It doesn't affect Sea Lion, because Sea Lion was going to fail anyway. That's the point I'm making. You see, he's just got not going to answer to this one. I'm feeling moderately pleased with myself. But I didn't come up with this. I was collared by somebody who said, try this one on James later. No, the gentleman there waving. It was his idea. There we go. Anyway, right. So
I'll return to that.
But let's get into Blunderland here, right? So 1941, which is strewn with
great British victories. Ethiopia, East Africa.
Yeah, I mean all the
Western Desert Force,
all the big stuff, all the like really important theatres.
You know, Battle of Atlantic.
Crete.
Of the world. Crete's not good. Crete's really bad.
Crete is absolutely...
Yeah, I think that's got to be in the top five, diabolical, hasn't it? Or right up there.
And one of the things I think is really interesting about Crete, and we talked about this quite recently. One of the things that, obviously, I think a top five, someone in their top five might say Ultra, right? Ultra's in the top five British things. I think the intelligence picture is so much more mixed than that. After all, fall of France, the Germans get their hands on the RAF's code books, the Army's code books. They've cracked the Navy's cipher. And the British realise that they can't build enough ciphering machines, Typex machines, to remedy this. So they carry on just knowing that their ciphers are blown.
Yeah.
And there ain't nothing they can do about it. And
that's got to be in the... I mean, that's right up there.
So if your view of the intelligence pictures, thanks to the Colossus,
we had
cracked Enigma and we industrialized Codebreaker. Well, actually, things were really, really, really bad and porous. And then, of course, later on in the war, the Germans go on and on about how slack we are with our radio drills, and that they can listen to everything, and everything's been talked about on
Rommel
open
gets
open
that,
comms.
That, I don't know, that
exactly,
one in the North
exactly.
Africa.
So I think, but I think the other thing that's interesting about Crete regarding Ultra is they know everything that's going to happen and still completely screw it up.
Yeah, it's even amazing.
It fits in the story of Ultra telling you everything the Germans are going to do, their intentions, their deployments, everything that's going to happen, the whole plan, the whole thing, and even knowing that,
they still lose.
You screw up. And you outnumber the other side 3-1, and you screw up that royally. And I think, I mean, we haven't ranked these yet, but you're probably getting my vibe on Crete here. What a mess they make of that, and how... Yeah.
It's such a simple thing.
It's a great...
Right from the top, from Wavell down to Freiburg, down to Hargist, you know, hold on to the airfield.
Yeah.
Okay? That's all you've got to do. It's not that hard when you've got 42,000 men, and you've only been attacked by 8,000 or whatever.
Yeah.
It should be possible.
Yeah, it's obvious. I mean, it's obvious to defend the airfield anyway. That doesn't give your ultra away. Anyway, so Crete. We agreed on that. That's a proper Allied blunder of the... Freiburg was a great bloke. He could
bloody
swim. He was a really bloody great bloke. Yeah, but a bloody great bloke.
He's Duke, so he's
really,
fine.
Really great swimmer. Really good at swimming. Yeah, he's a Duke. PC, he's Duke.
He's Duke.
So he's Duke. He's Duke. Yeah. Those of you who know the acronym that we're trying to force into historical parlance. And eventually,
invented by Al Murray.
Yeah, Dominions, UK, Empire, Duke.
No, I'm just trying to give you full credit.
And you put an X on the end, Duke X for Exiles, and I will make a historian use that in a book. Mm. I might be stood not that far from him. COVID compliant pressure being applied there.
A word I like to call, you know, a term I like to call Duke.
Duke. Right, so Crete.
By that,
so
I mean.
So that definitely goes into our sort of that's a proper blunt. Everything we've been talking so far is missteps and possibly half-baked decision making. But that's a like you have a situation here where you really shouldn't cock it up and you completely do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great. Yeah. So okay. So
I mean, you could say, does it really matter? But yeah. Yeah, it does matter.
It does matter because your army's getting in its head. It can't beat the Germans, and that is as important as anything else, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I'm happy.
Right,
okay,
I'm
good,
happy. Right, okay, I'm great. Okay, what else then?
Well, 1941 doesn't end very well, does it? Let's face it. You know, Pearl Harbor, and I know it's Americans, but you know, Hong Kong on Christmas Day, isn't it? And then obviously, you know, the big one, Malaya.
Yep.
Singapore,
yep.
Burma. Quick succession in the early part of 1942. You know, first half of 1942 is not great.
No.
Oh, I'll tell you what, another one from 1941, I would argue, is the failure to properly defend Malta in 1941. I know they do defend it, but the lack of Spitfires on Malta, I think, is a bad error.
Are you about to say Hugh Pugh Lloyd?
And do you know who I'd really like to point the finger about for that? Is the Air Officer Commanding, Air Vice Marshal Hugh Pugh Lloyd.
Now,
I mean, it is woeful. It's really bad because it's you know, I do think Malta is strategically important. I take mild issue with Max's take on this morning, that you know didn't, you know, he was saying that Malta is more important now that we know what we know now, but wasn't at the time particularly. But I think,
really?
Or maybe he was saying it the other way around. But anyway, the point was that
Malta for Malta
exactly.
Yeah.
But. I think Malta would have really, really changed the picture in 1941. If the Luftwaffe had come over with the Regia Aeronautica, the Italian Air Force, and been trounced by the RAF on Malta, which could have been entirely possible.
So a second mauling, as it were.
Yeah, in an air battle. I think that would have really changed the map in the Mediterranean. And that would have forced Germany to do one of two things. Either massively resupply the Mediterranean, which they couldn't afford to do because they're going into Barbarossa.
Yeah.
Or, well, they couldn't do it. So I think it would have been. I think that would have been. That would have been
actually a decisive.
Yeah, I think it probably would have been. And I think that would have kind of wrapped things up quite quicker, a lot quicker.
Really?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Gosh. So,
you know, and that's all because, you know, someone who is in charge of the air effort on Malta isn't requesting Spitfires when there's zillions of Spitfires available. And they're getting Hurricanes over, which, for all its brilliance, can't climb very fast. And the one thing you need on Malta is a plane that will climb fast so that it can intercept fighter planes and bombers coming from Sicily, 60 miles away, before they reach the island. It's so simple and it's so obvious. And I just cannot understand how they couldn't get that.
But is this not you've got to defend the UK primarily?
Yeah, but they're not defending it. They're doing rhubarbs and going on these fighter sweeps into France and just slaughtering lots of. Yeah, so that's also. I would put it all in one
the misapplication of the
misapplication
UK's fighter
of,
strength.
Yes. In 1941, I think, is really woeful.
Okay.
And I blame Sholto Douglas and I blame Lee Mannery, brother of the more famous John.
Yeah. Okay.
And I blame Hugh Pugh Lloyd.
Are you adding that? Is that. So well, that's going alongside. So it's.
That's a potential one.
So it's Mediterranean, really, where it's all going tits up.
Bit. But I think. Bit. But I think it's sort of. Yes, but I think you can sort of narrow it down a bit.
Now, I would say that the retreat in Burma and the blowing the bridge on the Sitang River before everyone has got across the Sitang River.
Yeah, that's not great.
Rates as one of my top blunders. That people are just not talking to each other.
No.
At that point, there's that massive. There's a big panic on.
Yep.
It's a rout, really.
Yeah.
And
after,
then
it's just not.
Yeah.
It's not fit for purpose.
Yeah. And then to then add that mistake.
And Singapore is just a gargantuan cock-up, isn't it? You know, they've just completely underestimated the Japanese. They don't realise... I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Had they known that they were going to be so brutal with all the prisoners and all the rest of it, would they have given up so easily? But even if they knew that and they wouldn't have given up so easily, that's still no excuse, is it? Because there's no excuse for giving up easily.
Well, yeah, but that's the thing. Again, Jonathan Fennell's talk yesterday, where he had the quote, which is, the Japanese soldier is prepared to die. Our men aren't.
The Duke
men are not prepared to die. How do we get our men to give their lives more dearly? Which is and they're not talking about Japanese supermen, which is the sort of which is the conception that's sort of doing the popular rounds. But the army thinking about what to do, reflecting what doing is saying. We need to find a way to mobilise people. And they're not motivated. I always think once you're east of Suez, mobilising Duke soldiers to fight for the Empire, because that's what they're doing east of Suez, they're fighting for the Empire. If you're fighting Japan, it's an imperial. That's the imperial war rather than the sort of the European struggle. Once you're east of Suez, how do you mobilise anybody? How do you motivate people?
And they're a polyglot force anyway, aren't
they? Well, I know they are.
And badly trained, and there's lots of Indian troops as well as British and Australians and all the rest of it, and they're badly equipped, they're badly trained.
Yeah.
The commanders are kind of sort of B-list.
Yeah.
They're kind of sort of military governors rather than kind of proper, you know, combat generals.
Yeah.
And they've just woefully underestimated the Japanese, who they look down their noses at and kind of think are racially inferior and all that kind of stuff. I mean,
it's a turnabout.
Because
they go from thinking they're inferior to then thinking they're supermen. So it's like, make your minds up.
Yeah.
I mean, which are they?
It's a really bad cock up.
Okay. So I think we've got four there now. We've got Crete. We've got the lack of defence of Malta and application of fighter.
Yeah.
So let's just call it Malta. Burma, Singapore.
Yeah, and then we've got what I think is the nadir of the British Army in the West, which is Gazala / Tobruk, fall of Tobruk, which is just, it's just really, really bad. And that is, you know, that's Auchinleck kind of having too big a command, the Middle East command. It goes all the way into sort of Iraq and Iran and all the rest of it. I mean, it's absolutely vast, and he's sort of scrabbling at trying to kind of work out what tactics they need to defeat the Deutsche Afrika Korps, which is pretty tiny anyway. Gazala's just terrible. And Ritchie has been bumped up from being, you know, an administrator at headquarters at GHQ in Cairo to suddenly thrust into the middle of a battle.
Why? Is he a good chap? Does he know the right people?
He is a good chap. He's a really good kind of, you know, desk jockey. And he's been very good as his deputy. And so basically the idea behind Auchinleck's thinking is that Ritchie is his man. He can control him and he can just steer it out there. But really the reins are being held by Auchinleck. But of course they're not, because it's a desert and it's miles away. And, you know, there's no WhatsApp group in those days and so on. And so, you know, he can't control him quite as easily. And Ritchie just doesn't have the respect of those corps commanders, which are multinational, which are Duke.
Yeah.
And they all start squabbling and they all start kind of disagreeing with each other, and they faff. They just faff so badly. That's why they lose. I mean, they should just, it's a situation that should just never, ever have been lost. The battle plan was terrible. Should have reinforced Tobruk. That would have been enough. But even by creating the Gazala line with all those boxes and stuff, that should have been more than enough.
Yeah.
I mean, the Afrika Corps goes round the back. The Italians are kind of hammering at the South Africans and the Australians at the top. But the Afrika Corps goes round the bottom, between the bottom and the Free French at Bir Hakeim. I mean, politically, that's not clever either, because there's a kind of sort of 40-mile gap.
Yeah.
You know, so that's just bad.
But the Germans have also penetrated all the signals and know what the British
do. They do. Yeah, absolutely. But that shouldn't be a problem, because there's a mobile reserve behind, the 7th Armoured Division behind, and they get in and they get sandwiched. They get sandwiched between the boxes, you know, an anvil and a hammer. Yeah. And the hammer should be, you know, the armoured, the mobile troops.
Yeah.
And the anvil is the boxes. It doesn't matter which direction your box is facing. It's still a box, and it's still surrounded by mines and wire and all the rest of it, and guns and blah, 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 and machine guns and mortars and all the rest of it. And that should be more than enough. And the reason they don't destroy them is because they faff around. They just can't make up their minds and no one acts. And, you know, they're D-list commanders, major generals and stuff. They're just people who are just not up to it. And it's a really, really bad moment.
Right. So
that would be 100% in my top five.
Okay, on your top five. Right, so that's 1942.
Ben Arthur Wright is brilliant.
Everything's rosier.
Well, dodecanese.
Dodecanese, 1943, anything?
Dodecanese is a kind of sort of, again, that's a major blip, isn't it? I mean, the thinking behind it is quite a good one, because if you can get through there, then you can get up and, you know, you can get into the Black Sea and you can, you know,
pop things open that way.
Yeah, you don't have the Arctic convoys anymore. That's a good thing. You know, it's helpful to the Soviets and blah, blah, blah. You know, that's all quite a good idea. The problem is the Americans just go, do you know what, we just haven't got enough kit to do this. Yeah. That's too far away. You know, it's not self-supporting enough. We're out. You know, if we're going to go into Italy, let's go into Italy, but let's not faff around in the Eastern Mediterranean. And it just feels like kind of post-war stuff that you're doing here rather than the case in hand.
Yeah.
And the British sort of go, no, we must do it, we must do it. It's going to be an easy victory. And it isn't, because before they even started, Rhodes falls.
Yeah.
Because this is post-September the 8th. This is post the Italian armistice. And the idea is that you take sort of Leros Kos and Rhodes particularly, and Simi and these little islands all around there, you know, next to Turkey. And it's just a complete fiasco.
This is Churchill, right, isn't it? Saying we ought to do this, and being a bit in love with the idea of Greece and helping the Greeks, and some sort of historic affection for the idea of of Greece, and actually all that not particularly hard-headed.
Yes, and also, so the basic principle behind Gallipoli in the first place was sound. It's just it didn't kind of work out. So this is the opportunity to prove it right. You know, Black Sea's actually a lifeline, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
You know, but it's just someone should have pulled the plug on that one a lot earlier.
When was the Scharnhorst Channel run? We've left that out. British fiascos.
Yeah.
Gneisenau, Prince Eugen. Yeah. When was that?
42.
42. So, okay, we're going to add that in to our blunders, just quickly. I mean, you know, we don't talk about the Navy, though, do we, on this podcast ever? So we could.
But when we do, we praise them.
Yeah, of course. So, that was a complete cock up as well. okay, so that's 43. 44?
Something really. I mean, we're going forward, aren't we? I mean, I suppose you could argue about Anzio, but I wouldn't argue that.
Didn't get to Con on D-Day, though, James.
What?
We didn't get to Con on D-Day, James.
Yeah, don't worry
Come
about
on.
That. Don't worry
I know I'm here in my Carlo d'Este cosplay.
No, don't worry about Con at all. You know. It's out of reach of what was possible. You know, it'd be great, but, you know.
All right.
I'm dismissing that one.
All right, and then 1945. Anything?
Well, Arnold, hang on a bit. What about Arnold?
We're not talking about Arnold. That was... totally.
No, that was 100% successful.
I don't want to be bounced into talking about Arnhem ever again.
Well, then it was plain sailing. It was only going forward, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So we're done.
Okay. So those. So
anything else?
Any other suggestions? Dieppe. Norway.
Well, you know, naval victory. Naval victory.
The Scheldt. Ignoring the Scheldt.
No. I'm not having that. I'm not having ignoring the Scheldt. They knew about Scheldt, but you know, you've only got so many men. You've got to, you know, you've got this chance of this strike to get around the Seafried line, get over the northern bit. You know, a striking victory by Christmas. You've got an allied airborne army. Go for it, but that you can't do everything. So you know, I'm all for Market Garden.
Okay, well, who'd ever thought I'd end up being the one lukewarm about Market Garden?
who'd have thought it? back me up here.
Okay. Any more? The Araucan offensive, the first two Araucan offensives are.
Yeah, oh God, we haven't done that. Yeah. No, I'm going to go. Yeah, absolutely. And actually, when I was scribbling down a few thoughts earlier on, the Araucan offensive of 1942, end of 1942, beginning of 1943, was right up there. Yeah. Thank you for reminding me about that one. Yeah, absolutely. That would be in my top five.
Okay,
that's terrible.
Any more?
General Noel Irwin going in there, battering it, trying to use European tactics against the Japanese in the jungle of what is now Rakhine State.
Yeah. Another one? Airborne at Husky.
Yeah, it's bad, isn't it? But, I mean, you know, is that a top five blunder?
Well, no. It's, I mean, the other way of flipping it is saying it's a very important set of lessons to be applied to D-Day, which gets you off the hook for an awful lot of Allied mistakes.
How are we doing for time?
Important lessons were learned as a result of that to complete balls up, chiefly not to balls up again. someone said Dieppe a moment ago. You know, Dieppe's hauled out as it's the fortuitous balls up, isn't it? Thank God we cocked that up, or we wouldn't learn any lessons.
Yeah, we'd have trying to cross at the Padakana.
What I want, Perkins, is you to get up in a kite right now, go over Germany, and not come back. What we need at this stage of the war is a futile gesture.
Very good, sir.
Exactly.
Consider it done. Can I just say, sir, it's been lovely knowing you.
Is it au revoir? No, Perkins.
It's adieu. It's goodbye. So I think we're there, are we? Our top five.
Yeah, any more for any more?
What about the misapplication of air power in 1941?
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Right, so we are talking.
I seem to remember I spent quite a lot of time talking about that one.
So we're talking Crete.
Yeah. That's the top five.
Tobruk. Gazala.
100% for me.
First Arakan offensive.
Singapore and Malaya. Singapore and Burma, Malaya. All in one.
So
you could just have them as three, but I think we should.
Yeah, so the basically response to the Japanese offences of 94.
Then we got one to go.
And then.
Dodecanese?
Malta. Yeah, Malta. There we go. Okay, those are our five.
Because Dodecanese is a cock up and it's bad and all the rest of it.
It's a sideshow.
But it doesn't really affect anything, does it?
Top five from 1939 to 1945, then? Allied successes.
Battle of Britain, Battle of the Atlantic, D-Day, Imphal, strategic air offensive.
Strategic air offensive? Yeah. Controversial.
But quite strong.
Yeah.
That's my top five.
So, okay, so what was the first one? Battle of Britain. Well, I've already thrown sand, dirt in there.
Yeah, but it completely changes the strategic picture. Totally, totally, totally. It's the first big bloody nose against Nazi Germany. And that's a good thing, obviously. It completely forces Hitler to go into the Soviet Union with catastrophic results earlier than he was planning.
Does it change it or does it make it apparent?
No, it changes it because you've got to have that engagement to make that happen. You still got to have the RAF in the summer of 1940 is not the final kind of last chance against the Nazi war machine. It's the first, but you've still got to defeat it.
Right.
You've still got to give the Luftwaffe a bloody nose. You've been running roughshod up until that point over absolutely everybody, with the possible exception of the air battle for Dunkirk.
Yeah.
But
well, and the losses to their transport wing with their airborne operations that have all gone wrong.
Yeah, that as well. But you know, the Battle of Britain is a game changer. Churchill says, Hitler knows he must conquer these islands or lose the war, and he's absolutely right.
Yeah, what I'm trying to say is it doesn't
matter because he was never going to do it anyway.
Well, maybe, but it doesn't change the game. It makes it clear what the game is.
All right.
Okay. Rather than changing the game, it points out to the Germans actually the situation they're in, rather than changes the situation they're in. It underlines it. It delineates it.
I think it's more than that. I really do. Because I think the Luftwaffe is so kind of on cloud nine by the end of the French campaign.
Yeah.
And I think it to the world as well. I think they just feel this is all conquering war machine.
Yeah.
And this is the first time that they get stopped in their tracks. And I think it's really important. And you know, we're talking about psychological factor as well. I think the importance of defeating the Luftwaffe over British skies is really, really important. I think, you can't sort of have them running roughshod and landing in the UK and then expecting the Navy to do all its work, and which it would have done. But already in the mind's eye of the nation, of the world, that's already a big, massive dent. You know, psychologically, politically, I think it would have been catastrophic.
So Battle of Britain.
That's my defence of that accusation. Okay.
Well, it's not an accusation. I was just trying to tease it out, Anyway, so what was number two? Battle of the Atlantic?
Battle of the Atlantic. Well, that's, as I think, you and I are one on this, that is the most important campaign of the entire Second World War because of so much traffic flowing through it. That affects the Pacific War as well. Yeah. But obviously, from Britain's sovereignty point of view, from the ability to kind of win in Europe, Britain's survival is absolutely essential, to that is the Battle of the Atlantic.
Because everything the Allies do is amphibious.
Yes.
Absolutely. Everything they're ever doing is an amphibious operation, one way or another.
Absolutely.
So even when they're deep into Belgium, that is it's essentially an amphibious operation because it's got to be supplied from America and the UK.
Yeah.
So effectively, everything they're doing is down to naval power.
Yeah, and by May 1940, although the Battle of the Atlantic is not, the U-boat force is not defeated until May 1943, by May 1941, the Allies have gotten to a position where they're not going to lose the Battle of the Atlantic. Yeah. They're just simply not. You know, the numbers, the advances in technology, the amount that the British are putting into winning the Battle of the Atlantic in that early stage of the war, at the potentially at the cost of other aspects of the war. But at that point, you know, they are... The Germans are simply not going to win.
Yeah.
Because it's not just the effort that the British and Canadians are putting into the Battle of the Atlantic. It's also what the Germans are not doing.
Yeah.
You know, and I do remember reading this report by General Warlamont, who is the man in charge of plans at the OKW, you know, the general staff of the German Armed Forces. And he's saying in a report in April 1942, he's saying, you know, we think that the Battle of the Atlantic and the Mediterranean are of equal significance. And they're just not, you know, that is why they're losing, because they don't understand what's most important to them.
Yeah. Because they're a continental power and nothing they do is amphibious.
Right, exactly.
As opposed to everything.
And Hitler is complete landlubber, isn't he?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, one of the interesting things, we were talking about the code-breaking thing, is that by 43, because the British know that the Germans have cracked their naval ciphers, they're directing U-boats, essentially, to convoys and saying, there's a convoy here, and directing the wolf packs to the convoys so they can attack the wolf packs.
Yeah.
And that's the state of dominance in the Battle of the Atlantic, that not only have you got the means to attack them, that you've got the intelligence and the SIGINT and everything to direct the U-boats to where you want them so you can destroy them.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, that's winning. That's fighting the battle completely on your terms.
Absolutely. And the Battle of the Atlantic, although there is this brief moment in the summer of 1942 through to the kind of Pearl Harbor where the Americans have the Atlantic Fleet and they're helping out, basically it's a Duke operation. It's a British and Canadian operation.
Well, how big's the Canadian Navy? Here we go. I love this stat. How big's the Canadian Navy at the start of the war?
It's like... Tiny, tiny, tiny. It's so like six ships. Or
and
something.
How many is it at the end of the war?
Well, 400 or something. I mean, it's incredible. Absolutely incredible. The Canadians 100% punch above their weight. I mean, they are absolutely remarkable. 86% of volunteers, I think.
Yeah.
You know, it's an incredible effort. And what they do, and they do in these crappy little corvettes and frigates and, you know, second-hand destroyers and all the rest of it is absolutely remarkable. And they're almost operating in the kind of worst part of the Atlantic as well, on that kind of sort of eastern, that western side of it, of North America. You know, that is the cruel sea of Nicholas Montserrat and all the rest of it. And they're unbelievably stoic and they learn incredibly quickly.
Yeah.
And, you know, they just play second fiddle to the British, the Royal Navy, because the Royal Navy are kind of, you know, it's Great Big Britain and, you know, top dogs and all the rest of it. But what Britain is doing is providing... For the most part, the technical know-how, you know, the hedgehogs, the improvements in ASDIC, you know, all this kind of stuff. And I suppose the Americans are playing an important part in those VLR liberators, closing the air gap and all the rest of it. But the reason you have the second happy time is because the Americans, when they enter the war, don't have a convoy system.
Yeah.
But the fact that the U-boats are on the far side of the Atlantic in the first place is a sign of weakness, because they've been forced over there because they're getting trounced in the middle of the Atlantic and on the western approaches. Yeah. You know, that's already been cut off to them. So, you know, and that happens, doesn't happen by May 1941, but the defeats that the Kriegsmarine, the German Navy, is suffering by the end of May 1941 are so significant that they're just not going to recover, and they're just not prioritising enough. They're not putting that R&D, that research and development, into it in the same way that Britain is, because Britain recognises that this is the number one theatre for them.
Okay, so then what was after? Was it Sicily?
No.
I mean, I was just giving you a chance to plug your book.
It's out in paperback, actually, in all good bookshops.
Really? It's in your email header, so...
Yeah. Well, you know, I've never done that before, but I thought, you know, I've got told off for not being punchy enough.
Right, so not
just
Sicily.
In case you ever forget.
In case I ever forget, yeah. What else?
Sicily 43, out now.
Yeah. The audiobook's better.
I'm incredibly proud of flying the flag for Great Britain.
Okay. Oh, God, don't. That's so funny. Go on.
It was really funny. Wasn't it?
So not what was next?
I just want to fly the flag for Great Britain a bit more.
Yeah, just want to fly the flag
for TPP.
Have you heard that?
We haven't put it out yet.
When we met the Red Arrows,
literally the funniest thing ever.
It's so funny that we'll never be invited again. We'll never be invited again. But the bloke doing the narrative. So we watched the Red Arrows rehearse, sort of over there,
And final dress rehearsal before the season.
Final dress rehearsal before the season begins. And we're given the check. I normally fly number nine.
Red 10.
But red 10. I normally red 10. But unfortunately, the kite's out of commission. Right? And you know what? Pilots look like, you know, pilots look like pilots. And he sort of.
Two pilots came in today, actually.
Yeah, they did. Your pilots.
How do you know? We haven't even got the.
Yeah, they're real, like, pilot chaps. And
they look permanently brown.
Yeah,
and there's a sort of sinewy, aren't they?
And their eyes are like focused, like 8 miles away,
yeah,
as well, like a hawk. Anyway, yeah. And he goes, he's giving this a
really
commentary.
So,
and what was really funny is you couldn't break him with banter. So he's going, I said, so, did you call yourself a red arrow?
I'm a red 10.
I'm red 10. I am a red arrow. Yeah, I said, I must be, if you're trying to pull, that must be really fantastic. Yes, I'm happily married, thank you very much. But yes, of course, it is a most useful.
In my bachelor days.
But the best bit is he kept saying, flying the flag for Great Britain.
Well, flying the flag for Great Britain, and it's a massive privilege. So I said, where are you flying the flag for Great Britain? Well, you know, lots of overseas, you know, displays. So how often, you know, as a percentage, how often are you flying overseas? Well, we fly twice. It's like, okay.
It's a great privilege. It's a great privilege to fly flag for Great Britain. No, we won't get asked back. But it was
really funny.
It was truly amazing.
We had a fantastic day, so we're being really mean.
And they were
absolutely lovely.
Yeah, and they get given the red uniforms when they're signed off as display
competent.
Olive drab up to then, yeah. And then they become red arrows.
And the ground crew in blue.
Yeah, the ground crew in bright blue. So if you see a red arrow plane going by, and the guy's wearing bright blue, the mechanic's flying it, is what that means. Anyway, so...
Fly the flag for GB.
Fly the flag for Great Britain, yeah.
Anyway, so where were we?
Twice.
So we've done Atlantic, and I've pushed hard for Battle of Britain.
Yeah.
D-Day.
D-Day.
D-Day. Frickin' A. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
You know, I know we all think it's, you know, Americans jumping out of landing craft on Omaha Beach, but, you know, all three service chiefs, two-thirds of the Air Force.
Basically all the naval force.
892 out of 1,213 warships, Royal Navy. 3,126 out of 4,027 landing craft, British.
Yeah. Well, and also, the heavy metal...
Just to splatter a few stats at you.
The heavy metal is the British end of the lodgement, because they're expected to do the armoured fighting and to soak up... That is the plan, the Matador's Cape, to soak up the armour on the right flank, and the British are given left flank rather, and the British are given that job.
Yeah, base from which it's launched.
Yeah,
all three. Well,
but you can't take credit for the fact it's launched from the UK.
Of course you can.
Well, because we weren't going to launch it from Iceland, were we?
No, I know, but
that would be a silly thing to do.
No, of course, but I'm just
that
saying,
would
you know.
Be a top five blunder.
Along with Pycrete.
Yeah, Pycrete. Oh, I love the idea of Pycrete.
I've got a frightfully good idea.
If Pycrete had worked, we'd all be wanging on about it, wouldn't we? But it didn't.
I just love the idea of a sawdust and ice aircraft carrier.
Did they try it?
I don't know. It's just bonkers.
It's a thing. It's always sort of every 5 years.
Panacea mongers.
Yeah, exactly. Every 5 years, it's in a newspaper going, the most amazing thing revealed, Pycrete. Yeah, I know. Told us 5 years ago.
Sure, and it's just discovered a bit of unfrozen, unfrozen pycrete.
Thawed pycrete.
In Iceland.
Yep. Yeah. Pycrete found on butcher's floor.
In Reykjavik.
In Reykjavik, yeah. So D-Day, you're saying?
Yeah, I think so.
Because I would go further. I would say the Battle of Normandy. I think I would say the whole thing.
Yeah, all right.
And I would say...
Well, 1st of August, you know, Americans sort of take over, don't they? But
yeah, but that phase of the liberation of Europe, which is the decisive battle, and you cocked that up, and that is the British, I mean, all the criticism of the British that's so baked in that they're, you know, and we've talked about this before, they're too slow, or they're too cautious, well, or not fast enough, well, faster than what, slower than what, in the circumstances, and given the entire philosophy of trying,
yeah, but they didn't do a great big deep battle and sort of, you know, throw everything in and have mass slaughter.
No, because you can't do that.
No,
and you're
because you're Western democracy and
it's a citizen army and all that sort of stuff. Yeah. So I would say not just D-Day but the Battle of Normandy itself.
The whole thing. Yeah, the whole show.
All right. Yep. I'm happy with that. Okay. Obviously, being a Brit here in England on a summer's evening, I'm very happy with that.
Okay. And then what was number four? Is it Market Garden?
Infall.
Oh, sorry. Infall. Yeah. Infall. Yeah. Well,
Britain's Greatest Battle, as voted for by people in the National Army Museum.
Really?
Yes.
Well, that's a general store poll of the population, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's incredibly balanced. Not in any way partisan whatsoever. And with no modern bias at all.
But you're including Kohima. It's the whole thing, isn't it?
It's the whole big thing.
That whole campaign.
Yeah. Right? It's just, I think what's interesting about it is it's such a different battle to the one that British forces, Duke forces, traditionally fight.
Yeah.
And the whole idea about it is that you don't just beat the Japanese, you destroy the Japanese as much as you absolutely possibly can. This is a war of, you know, this is a battle of an intended annihilation against the Japanese 15th Army. And the idea about it is to, it's really dangerous because the idea is to have these outposts all, so you've got Imphal, which is actually not in Burma, well, it's part of the Burma campaign, it's not in Burma at all, it's actually in India.
Yeah.
It's in Manipur state as it is now. And it's in this sort of flat bit, but it's surrounded by hills and not mountains, but hills and jungle and all the rest of it. But there is this plain. And where there's a plain, obviously, you can have airfields. So that's good because we've kind of got on top of that particular one. So the idea is to have these outposts all around in a sort of ring around or kind of a half ring around Imphal and take on the Japanese at these outer extremes, but then have a fighting retreat, which is just not part of the kind of British language, military language at all. And as you retreat, you attrit your enemy, you grind them down and you extend their supply lines. And then just as they're kind of within an inch of their target, Imphal, you massively resupply because you've got airfields around it, and then you counterattack and smash them and completely destroy them. And broadly speaking, that is what happens. But of course, there's all sorts of hiccups and things that go wrong and nearly go wrong and near disasters and all the rest of it. But it is an incredibly punchy plan. And that is completely devised by Slim and supported by his senior commanders, all of which are largely forgotten today, but are really, really competent. I mean, you know, Montague Stopford, Punch Cowan, Frank Messervy, all these people, you know.
What if the Japanese Gracie. Resisted the temptation to engage with these boxes?
Well, then it would have just...
Because you know, the Americans do a similar thing. Well, the French do it at Dien Bien Phu, don't they? They build a big box, and the idea is that the Vietnamese will come to them to fight, and you have a battle, and you defeat them.
Yeah.
And it doesn't work. And then the Americans do the same thing at Dien Bien Phu, where they build an enormous thing, and 101st Airborne are there, and the air cavalry are there, and the big idea is that the Vietnamese will turn up, and you'll have a battle and fight, and defeat them. And the Vietnamese don't show up.
Yeah.
So what if the Japanese had not succumbed to temptation? Were these positions bypassable? You know,
They're absolutely not bypassable. They're not bypassable, and that is the key to the whole thing. Because if the Japanese can possibly stay in Burma, but if they want the jewel in the crown, if they actually do want,
but
India,
if there's
which
any
they
point,
do,
any and, point and the to main Burma, reason, you've got well, to go to India.
The jewel for them is not really India; it's destroying the airfields of Assam.
Yeah,
because if you hold Burma, you then destroy the Burma Road, which means the Allies can't get into resupplying the Chinese nationalists under Chiang Kai-shek. But the alternative after that, after the fall of Burma, is the airfields of Assam, where they're flying over the hump, over the Himalayas, and supplying them by air. But if you can take those,
so you disrupt not only
then you potentially change everything.
Well, you change everything. So you change the war in China and you change the war in India. So it's like a double whammy.
Yes, it's a potentially a massive war-changing victory. Doesn't mean say they're not going to sort of that they'll be able to hang on to those islands in the Pacific, but what it does mean is they might be able to defeat China, which might be enough, because the only reason they've gone into kind of, you know, French Indochina and all those other places in the first place is because they haven't got
they
haven't won in China. So, you know, what do you do? So I don't think the Japanese can sort of avoid it. You know, at higher headquarters, they're just saying, no, let's just hold Burma. But Mutaguchi, who is the commander of the 15th Army, the Japanese 15th Army, he's going, no, this is our potential. This is what we're going to do. So he's always going to go for it.
And they can't stop him?
Well, no, because he doesn't say that's what he's going to do. He just says, I'm going to attack him, and get it and get those airfields, which would be really important. And all this. Right. And they go, yeah, okay, crack on that, and that will help us to save Burma. But then he goes, overreaches himself.
Okay.
And the plan for Burma, you know, the Slim's plan works an absolute treat.
Yeah. Okay, so that's Imphal. And what was the fifth one?
Well, I was going to say strategic air campaign,
yeah. Yeah.
Well, because I just, you know, you think about, I mean, obviously that's a joint operation, but the British start it first, and, you know, that it's the longest campaign of the war, isn't it?
Well, or the Battle of Atlantic.
Battle of Atlantic is won by 1943, isn't it?
Right, well, I suppose, but yeah, right.
Yeah, it starts on the 3rd of September 1939.
All right, okay.
I would argue that you know, you can forget about it. You know, let's not argue about morals.
That's exactly where I was going. So, the controversy aside, the moral aspect of it all, you just simply have to put that aside. And maybe, I mean, earlier on, I was doing this questions thing and talking about the idea of when the Second World War becomes like a piece of history, so you maybe are able to not get tangled up in the that question. But then that does that then also distance you from the Nazis' crimes? Although I'm not saying that the strategic air campaign is comparable in that way, but some people think it is. Some people think morally it sits in the same spectrum. So I mean, you don't mind that you're saying it's. It's the only way to skin the cat, as it were.
Well, I think so. I mean, you know, the point about the strategic air campaign is the moment you give up fighting, we'll stop bombing you.
Yeah.
You know, and they've made that absolutely clear right from the word go.
Yeah.
And you know, if you think about most wars, I mean, there are exceptions, but most wars, generally, I mean, you think about the First World War, you know, why did the Germans surrender in November 1918? It's because they've run out of cash and they're not going to win. You know, by that argument, you could... I mean, I know you say Stalingrad, I say November 1941, but I mean, you know, the Germans are just not going to win. You know, by the end of 1941, I can't see how they could possibly win.
Yeah, but you also still need a decisive battle for the message, for the penny to drop, don't you?
Because yeah, I mean, revolutionary
France is broke, and Napoleonic France is sort of broke the entire time.
Before
it even gets going, and they carry on anyway because they're into it.
But there's no question, if you're destroying whole cities, that is not helpful to your war effort.
No.
In any shape or form. And that is also helping to preserve the lives of your own young men, whether they be American or Duke or whatever. You know, so, I mean, the mayhem in which Germany was left in 1945, by the end of the war in 1945, I mean, clearly that had a massive adverse effect on the Germans' ability to protract the war.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, you look at the amount of bombs that the Luftwaffe are dropping on London, for example, 18,000 tons in the entire war, I think it was, you know, which is a lot, but it's...
That's an afternoon by 9:45, isn't it?
Yeah, right. You know, I mean, it's best part of a million tons dropped on Germany just by the RAF Bomber Command alone. You know, that's before you even included the Americans from 15th Air Force and 8th Air Force.
Okay, right. So those are our top five. Any suggestions from the floor? El Alamein, Battle of Malta. There we go. You see, I like that because that's like Dieppe. Important lesson in crucial lessons learned.
Well, I think the interesting thing about Alamein is that, you know, it's always seen as Monty who comes in and goes, "There's going to be no more reverses."
It was Monty.
It wasn't. It was Alexander.
It was Monty.
And Alexander comes in ahead of Monty and he goes to Cairo and he gets very upset by what he sees and the terrible morale, and he goes, "Right, we've got to have a simple message. The simple message is no more reverses." Which is then adopted by Montgomery for 8th Army and for obvious, very, very good reasons. And Montgomery absolutely grips it. There's no question about it. But Alexander grips it as well. You know, so it's that twin effort, I think.
Yeah.
And suddenly there's a kind of sort of change at the top, different atmosphere. They both complement each other brilliantly. They're both bringing different things to the table.
Yeah.
But suddenly you've got a winning team.
Yeah. And someone,
they never go backwards, apart from Arnhem.
And Montgomery is really interesting because he is a deep thinker. He notoriously spent the interwar years talking shop, didn't he?
Yeah.
He was one of those people who would
spit in for dig.
Exactly, would insist on talking shop and was really, really interested in how to make things work. I mean, so yeah, maybe Alamein, but then yeah, I go Alamein actually. And also, you've broken the voodoo, the thing we talked about in 1941, where the Germans appear unbeatable under any circumstances, even when you outnumber them and know what they're going to do, they still defeat you at Crete or at Tobruk. I think Alamein.
All right, but are you putting that as just a sixth one because we're changing the rules, or are we going to bump one of the others off?
I think D-Day. I mean, it's a bit overcooked, isn't it?
maybe.
Have you got a book? Have you written a book? Oh, no, let's not go there. Any other suggestions?
Sicily 43, though.
Yes, Sicily 43. Yes, there's
it's on my email.
There's
now.
two people there. One in a hat. Yes, Tunisia. They captured the Axis arms in Tunisia.
Yeah. Well, I'm talking about that tomorrow morning, so.
So if you want to know more, I think that's pretty good, actually.
I was thinking about it yesterday, actually. I hadn't really thought about it before, but I was thinking yesterday that actually the Germans, why did Hitler send them to Tunisia? Why didn't he just stuff them into southern Italy and Sicily? All those troops, those 250,000 troops and armoured troops, and why didn't they put them back earlier?
Because
you're Hitler
you can't go backwards.
Yeah.
Your car doesn't have a reverse gear, does it? And then there was someone just behind the fellow in the hat. Yep.
Oh, I'm glad you brought that up. Enigma.
No, evacuation of Dunkirk. I'm going with I'm going with my heckler.
Enigma.
Evacuation of Dunkirk is a triumph.
It is, but you don't win wars from evacuations.
Well, actually, turns out you do. Because if we had not pulled that off successfully, and you go back to the psychological, political
back
things
to the garden,
flying
back
around
to the garden
in
number
10. Back garden number 10.
Yeah.
And I still think maybe Halifax thought, it still may all go wrong, so I'll hold off for now.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. I hadn't thought about that before, but actually, I buy into that.
Yeah, he's thinking, well, Churchill's unreliable.
Come on, Edward.
Exactly. Churchill's unreliable. He's not got any backing in the Conservative Party at all. He's not clubbable. He doesn't know anyone. He doesn't have any party backing. He's pissed half the time. He's also not head of the Conservative Party because Chamberlain still is.
Yeah.
And he doesn't take that job until Chamberlain dies.
No.
Until after Chamberlain dies, and has to be told he has to do it. Because he doesn't want to do it because he's not.
I'm a bit of a liberal.
Don't do impressions. But Enigma.
I'll leave that to you.
Enigma. No, we dealt with Enigma earlier. Yes. In the red baseball cap. Cartwright Jones in Where Eagles Dare is a masterstroke. A British human double cross. Yeah. Okay, I'll take that. It's a burgeoning top five now. It's got eight things in it.
God, we were good, weren't we?
Yeah, yeah. Any more for any more? The Great Escape. We're not talking about films.
Okay, there's a big distinction. Okay, movie is one thing, and that's great, and we all enjoy them. But they're not reality.
And then up there in the very slick-looking gentleman in the shades. Lend-lease.
Yeah, but... Yeah, ah. Okay. Yeah, British Lend-lease to the Soviet Union. Yeah, interesting.
No. Clinching the Lend-lease deal. Do you mean that? Going to America and emitting...
Well, the thing is, if your neighbour's house is on fire...
We're not the Americans.
You've got a hose pipe.
But they're not our neighbours.
No.
That's the thing. I think that's very good, actually. But aren't we may have to bump some of his other ones for that.
The British commissioning the Mustang in May 1940.
Over there, the Piat or the Bailey Bridge.
Yeah. British innovation.
Someone managed to bring up the Piat there, thank you.
Yeah, no, that's very good. So generic kind of British inventions in the Second World War.
Yeah, the technological leaps and bounds.
Yeah, I think you could argue that quite a lot.
Okay.
There's lots of that, cavity magnetron. And I've never mentioned that before.
You never talk about the Kevin Magtron. Okay. Well, I think we've got our top five blunders and our top five triumphs. And it says time's up on the screen, but that's never affected me before in my life. Yes, the lady there. Mincemeat.
No. And no effect whatsoever. No effect whatsoever. It dissuaded no one and persuaded no one.
You haven't written a book about that then?
No, but it's a really good one, and there's a film coming out, apparently. And Ben McIntyre's a bloody good bloke.
So, James, if you had to pick one blunder and one triumph, let's put another log on the fire while you decide.
Singapore's the absolute nadir.
And also means that the Australians then go, all right.
And the Battle of the Atlantic.
Okay, right, there we go. There we go. That, I think, is all we've got time for.
Yeah, that's it.
Because we've got histrionics to do as well. Thanks, everybody, for joining us and for your contributions and questions and answers and insistence that we're Eagles Dare is canon. thank you.
Hello, listeners. It's Anita Arnand here from the Goalhanger sister podcast, Empire, which I host along with...
me, William Dalrymple. And we are here to tell you about our new series on the Founding Fathers, the men who made America.
We wanted to look at the men who actually founded the country, who dreamt the dream, who wrote the words upon which a country would be born. What were they like? What made them do what they did? What did they actually believe in? And how did they come to play the role that they did in the American Revolution and the creation of America?
What really interested me about this was the contradictions. I mean, we expect these men to be great figures. We've seen the portraits in the galleries. We know the faces from the banknotes. But they're deeply complex figures. But in that, and in that blend of contradiction and intellectual power and writing genius and curiosity and raw ability, lies the nuance and complexity that allows us to understand them. And the United States is in many ways a reflection of them, their beliefs, their experiences.
These are the men who wrote the Constitution. These are the men who created the federal system. In every way, they are totally fundamental to what American politics looks like today.
It all goes back to this extraordinary group of men.
Yeah, and they have rip-roaring yarns as well, let me tell you. So if you want to know why America is the way it is and who the men were who made it, you can listen by searching Empire wherever you get your podcasts.